deeply. I think very deeply.
In about 4 seconds, a teacher will begin to speak.
I think very deeply.
Let us begin.
Okay, so we're here with Lisa Alva. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. I'm glad you made it. So Lisa is National Board Certified Teacher, and there's a lot of things here. You are on the board of directors for the Partnership for Early Schools. You've been at Roosevelt 11 years, and you've taught for 14. You are with New TLA, the group that's trying to take over the teachers union, UTLA. And you're here today. Welcome. Thank you. I guess we could start with New TLA because that's where I met you. What's that?
New TLA, I see as a group of highly dynamic, really super intelligent, very proactive teachers who, like me, are simply fed up with the way that teachers are represented in the media and in the public mind and the way that we're perceived. And realize that we've done a lot of it to ourselves through the union, perhaps. And just want to begin to make a change in the way teachers are perceived by doing business differently, doing business more proactively, doing business a little bit more efficiently, and with students really at the middle of the conversation and not, you know, whatever else we have been talking about, foreign policy issues.
Okay, and you're in the Partnership for LA Schools, which is, you're on the board of directors, which seems like a really important position. I mean, it sounds important.
It is, because I can bring a perspective, I can bring a teacher perspective to the governing body of the Partnership for Los Angeles Schools, and people think that it belongs to the mayor, and it kind of does, but only peripherally. We're like a very small district, mini district, or oversight body for some 22 schools in the Los Angeles area, in East Los Angeles and South Los Angeles. But, you know, we don't see the mayor, and it's not like he's got an agenda that we're pushing. We just manage ourselves, and we happen to be under his auspices, or under the auspices of iDesign, which is a part of LA Unified School District. So we're a full school, you know, LA Unified School program. But being on the board allows me to see what the partnership is doing system-wide, you know, across its own schools, and have a little bit of say in terms of holding people accountable for how money is spent and how decisions are made, and what the future holds.
Mm-hmm. And do you see how many real teachers do they have on there, on the board?
Two. There's myself and Trebor Jacques. He
Wow.
teaches at Santee High School.
So two of the teachers, they're both in New TLA?
Yes.
Okay.
Two teachers. We have our major funder, Melanie Lundquist, philanthropist, and really, you know, a wonderful woman. She has given the partnership $50 million over 5 years, and she allows us to make our own decisions as a board of directors, as an organization, as the partnership, as to how, what we're going to do with that money and how it's going to be spent, and with what goals in mind. I was a panelist on Education Nation and then was able to attend the Job 1 panel that was hosted by Brian Williams about a week ago, and there were business people and philanthropists on that board. Eli Broad was there, Mike Milliken was there, a woman named Maria Contreras Sweet, she's a banker, another woman named Linda Resnick, she's the founder of Palm Industries, I guess they make the pomegranate juice, and she's done a million other things. Teleflora, she's this huge, huge business person, entrepreneur, and now a philanthropist. And they really want to direct the agenda for teachers specifically. And they just don't have right. really an idea of what we endure every day.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that a lot of people have been sort of concerned about, is the billionaire reformers of education. And, you know, they're not anywhere near the reality of teaching. How can they know what works? I guess they're just... they look at the studies and they make their conclusions.
The billionaires and the business people really have a misperception that you can do what you want with students, and that we're not doing the right thing with students or to students or for students. And so they think that you can treat them like a commodity or a raw material, and put them into this machine that we call school. And if you do it right, then they're going to pop out the other side graduates. To a person, they didn't really seem to understand what the plight is of the urban student in America today. I'll give you an example. Brian Williams, bless his heart, he's really funny, actually. He has a good stand-up routine that he did.
Who's Brian Williams?
Brian Williams is an anchorman. Yeah, NBC television. I think he's in Joplin, actually, Missouri right now, actually on scene. Anyway, he does the nightly news on NBC.
Something's going on in Missouri?
Yeah, the tornado thing. He's there monitoring that. Anyway, he said something that disturbed me. There were a lot of things that disturbed me on that Job One panel. You can still see it on educationnation.com. Mm-hmm. It's an NBC website. Isn't it ironic, he says to Eli Broad, that kids come into classrooms and they put away their laptops and they put away their iPads and they put away their iPhones and take out their earbuds, and then they're forced to sit in rows and listen to lectures.
And use pencil and paper.
Yeah, which, you know, if number one, my students don't have all that stuff. and number two, when they come into the classroom, the last thing we're doing is sitting in rows and, you know, listening to me give a lecture on poetics or whatever. You know, it's just not happening. It's more interactive. It's more hands-on. And, you know, the whole issue of technology. And then the other thing, whether, you know, the kids have it or not.
Well, that's such an orthodoxy. You know, how many times have I heard sitting in rows? Like, that's... Yeah. I mean, okay, great. So sitting in rows, fine. It's not the best. Maybe it's not the best thing. But, like, it's become this, like, article of belief that the way to fix education is if we would not sit in rows.
Yeah, I don't know too many classrooms, actually, where kids sit in rows.
Well, that's because, you know, that's because of this.
Yeah, we just don't learn very well that way.
I'm sorry, but you were going somewhere.
Yeah, I was. I was explaining that the business people just don't seem to get it. They don't seem to understand that we're dealing with individuals that have thoughts and feelings and emotions and hormones as they're growing up, and all of these things come into play for a classroom teacher, and sometimes our children don't want to be there. They just don't want to be in the classroom. They'd rather do something else. And this is something that I find really interesting. You know that we have a new state law that says that unless you have a Tdap booster, you can't come to school starting in September. Unless you have a tetanus, diphtheria, pertussis shot, you can't come to school. And some of my students, sadly, see this as a win-win situation. No shot, no school.
Hmm.
And how do you put that little cog into the businessman's machine? You know, how where does that belief come from? Where does it, how is that a good thing that you can't come to school if you don't protect yourself with a vaccination? I'm still thinking my way through that one, but it's
I just see them as being all data driven and which I think can be a good thing. I mean, I feel like maybe we shouldn't resist some of the things that they're doing, that they need our help to explain to them how it really looks.
Yeah, Nick, I absolutely agree. I have, I was a business person myself in a past life, and I have a master's in business administration, and I love data. I love looking at data, and I love collecting it, and I love sharing it with students and using data for my students in my classroom to set their own goals. However, when you're a businessman and you're looking at the number of kids graduating and the numbers of teachers and teacher salaries and all that, that's a different kind of data that doesn't serve us in the classroom very well. When you have those people talking about it, and they have billions of dollars with which to exercise influence, and they use it. And it's not appropriate. But yeah, data, absolutely data, everything. I believe you can measure everything, anything, attitude, perception.
I guess they do know... They do know something, but they need to be they're not the adults here in this situation.
Yeah, the business people.
Yeah,
Byron August, who is a think tank guy, he works for the McKinsey company and does research. Was there to speak about at the Job One panel to speak about the achievement gap. And he noted that there are four kinds of achievement gaps. There's the United States versus everybody else in the world, notably Asia and some Northern European countries. There is the achievement gap between states in the United States, California versus Texas versus Massachusetts or what have you. And then there are those achievement gaps that are based on race and income.
And in our school district in Southern California, here in this very urban environment, we have to start it there with the race and the income issues. And we have to deal with that situation. Mm-hmm. And the answer doesn't necessarily lie in giving away more things. You know, I have a friend who works at a school, a middle school, where every sixth grader was given a laptop.
My school.
Yeah.
At my school, too.
Oh, at yours? Okay. But this was one of the mayor's partnership school, you know, the Partnership for Los Angeles Schools. This was one of those initiatives, you know, that we're going to spend money on technology because it's important. But now the students won't bring the laptops. They won't carry the laptops. They don't want the laptops because they're, quote, too heavy.
Right. Actually, at my school, it's desktops they're given.
Yeah. Wow.
But, it's not, I guess, so it's not about giving them things. But don't these achievement gaps just reflect society? I mean, are schools going to fix achievement gaps that are, I mean, you know, people come from their mansions and their private tutors and their, you know, their after school lessons and their and all of this, and then we're going to somehow equalize, you know, their education with somebody who's got, you know, nobody at home and everybody's working out and everybody, I mean, working outside,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and you know, many family members and taking care of other family members. How is that going to be resolved at a school? I mean, by teachers?
Well, the buzzword is highly effective teaching. We're supposed to be highly effective. It's our fault, basically. Because we're not highly effective teachers, the cogs are not cooperating in the machine.
Are they really not? Are they really believing that, you know, we can close the gap just in schools and you know, the rest of what happens outside the schools doesn't matter?
No,
they don't.
I really don't think that. So. I mean, that was there was not enough time for a really far-ranging conversation, but it did kind of focus on teacher quality, the conversations that I've been a part of, mm-hmm. You know, with the Education Nation thing. We all know that there are societal influences at work, but how much can we really control? I don't see how we can really control anything that happens outside the gates. We only have control of what happens inside the gates. Yeah. And so, therefore, not only is teacher effectiveness important, but how effective can I be as a teacher if I have poor leadership or if I have no collaboration? Mm-hmm. And if I have collaboration without leadership, then it's not going anywhere. We're not getting any data. We're not looking at it, not measuring it, not collecting it, not enforcing those rules upon ourselves that really will help us make a difference. And then there's the whole question of student motivation, because some of my students, my kids that sit in my classroom, are resistant. They don't see the value in what I'm trying to communicate. And so it becomes part of our effort as teachers and as effective schools and as effective leaders, and principals come into the picture, is to make school relevant to kids by helping them understand how an education really helps solve your problem. Like, whatever problem it is that you're dealing with, whatever it is, like a kid will come to school and say, I'm tired, I'm sleepy. Well, why are you tired and sleepy? Well, there was a ruckus down the hall. There was a ruckus in my apartment building. Okay, so the problem is that you didn't sleep because there was someone down the hall that was having an interaction with the police, for example, or with somebody else. So what's the solution for that? It's to get out of that environment, to be in an environment that's a little quieter. How are you going to do that? Well, you need money. How are you going to get money? You need an education. That's why you need to sit in this seat and do some algebra, or learn some history or economics.
And does that... Do you do reason with your students like that?
Well, here's where the leadership comes in, and here's where the collaboration comes in. Because if I'm the only person in your life that's giving you that message, how believable is it? Mm-hmm. But if I'm one of six teachers that hammer that kind of thing home all day, then it begins to seem a little bit more realistic or a little bit more relevant.
And do you have that kind of
collaboration? I do not. I do not. No, I'm isolated myself.
I've never been anything but isolated mm-hmm. at my school.
Yeah. It's a sad, sad thing. I had the privilege last summer of running a bridge program for incoming ninth graders, and I was the coordinator of it, kind of a quasi-administrator, a quasi-principal. And We had articulation between ourselves. We had collaboration between ourselves every Friday. We had 4 hours to get together and talk in teacher groups. We got together as in content areas. We got together then in our. We have 7 small schools at Roosevelt, and each one of them was represented as with a teacher group during the Summer Bridge program. And the teachers were able to sit and plan together. We had one. We had actually common assessments that we did twice. We had one prompt for math and one prompt for English, and we gave common assessments. We did it right at the beginning. We collected data. We analyzed it. We looked at where the kids were on a very simple rubric and then made plans. The teacher groups individually made plans to address the areas where the students showed need. And in 4 weeks, we had growth. When we gave the assessments again the second time, we had growth. And it came about because the teachers were able to identify problems that were important to them, things that they wanted to solve, things that they wanted to know, and I provided the support and the time and the resources to enable them to achieve their vision. And so leadership becomes totally important, but they were accountable too, though. You know, they had to come to the table with the assessments or with the student work, and we looked at student work all the time. So how... You know, that's the kind of thing that needs to happen.
Mm-hmm. So do you see this happening? I mean, is it going to happen? Are we going to have leadership?
It takes... well, John Deasy and Eli Brode, you know, and the business people in the room do see a need, and the mayor does too, for improving leadership. And my own colleagues at the Partnership for Los Angeles Schools see the need for improving leadership. But it's one thing to say something, and then it's another thing to do it. And until there is a serious attempt at evaluating administrator effectiveness, I don't know how far we're going to get. When was the last time you evaluated your principal and it made a difference?
No, there was some form... survey on like Survey Monkey, but it was I didn't fill it out.
It doesn't make a difference,
yeah,
though. We can say what we want about a principal, and I've seen some principal evaluation data, but it's only because I'm privileged to that information as a board member for the partnership. But it's not anything, you know, that my existence there and my existence as a classroom teacher are two completely different things.
Your role on the board and your...
Completely different, yeah. What I'm saying is that the level of information and communication that I get as a board member is head and shoulders above what I get as a teacher. And it's trust. I imagine it's trust. You know, why else would your boss hold information so closely?
What kind of information?
Well, information around, let's say, planning a master schedule, or information around seniority, so that teachers, you know, could make a case for choosing to teach different classes. Information around what other teacher groups are doing. You know, why can't we know what that teacher group? Why do we have any secrets at all in a school site? If we're all really there for the betterment of students, why can't we share, you know, more freely?
And the agendas are never set by the teachers for professional developments.
No, not in my small school. No, not at mine. Well, ostensibly they are. There, you know, was a committee in my small school that decided what we would do for professional development. But it's moving very slowly. But in other teacher groups, in other small schools, at my school site, which is Roosevelt High School, there are very strong teacher leaders, and there's collaboration, and it's voluntary, of course. I mean, we have the same contract as anybody else at Roosevelt, but some teachers do feel strongly about the collaborative work that they do, and their principal supports them in it.
Which school is this?
There would be the School of Law and Government at Roosevelt, and there's the Magnet School, and there's one other. I'm thinking specifically of those schools whose teachers asked, communications, new media, and technology. The teachers asked for a different bell schedule so that they could offer more classes. They're going on a block schedule where a student will take 8 classes per semester, but like on alternating A and B weeks. Mm-hmm. And that will allow them, because they're going to work 7 minutes longer every day, they'll have extra time for professional development. And that way then their bell schedule will allow them to have a late start. I think it's 2 days a month, or I'm not really sure about the specifics. But
there's a lot for teachers to keep track of. It seems almost impossible to have all that in your head and then, you know, your subject, too. Almost.
Yeah.
I don't know how. I guess if you do it long enough.
Yeah, but the wonderful thing about these particular teacher groups is that they're all of one mind. Mm-hmm. You know, they all have the same objective, which is to educate their students at any cost to themselves or, you know, and it's a struggle. I mean, I see them struggling.
Should it have to be?
It
at
should.
A cost
no.
To yourself?
Well, no.
Can
no.
you really ask?
They spend their lunches together. Mm-hmm. And they spend, you know, they have regular meeting times. Actually, yeah. Many teacher groups do. But the thing, too, is that they're philosophically aligned. You know, there is this one group of teachers in the magnet at Roosevelt who are all very well read in Paulo Freire and transformational resistance. And they openly discuss these things. And now you can't really, there's no content standard for moving yourself from being resistant to being transformational with your life, or having teaching students how to do that, how to break out of being oppressed without oppressing other people. That's not in the content standards, but it's so vital. It's so critically vitally important for our students to understand. And this is the thing I was trying to get at earlier. If I'm going to understand the purpose of an education and then try to educate myself, discipline myself so you don't have to discipline me, and be open-minded and a learner so that you don't have to drill it into me, then suddenly we're working together for the same end. And it becomes possible for me to move out of my negative economic situation into one that's a little more positive and productive for myself and my family.
Okay, that sounded really good. Is this, what's your classes look like? Do they look like this sounds?
My classes do not. Mm-hmm. I don't know how to do this. I don't, it would require, to teach this kind of a curriculum, this transformational curriculum.
You need a tree. You need to be under a tree.
Right? Trees are nice, yeah. But you need to have a group of teachers that you can work with, that you can swap ideas with. You need to have access to readings and then know how to, like, for example, Malcolm X, right? Let's read the autobiography of Malcolm X. But we need to be able to have that. And then we need to be able to get into it as teacher groups and figure out, okay, what's important here? What are the main messages that we want our students to get out of this? And then how do we support them in understanding it? And then how do we transform that new understanding into actual activity so that it, you know, so that the kids are actually doing something with this knowledge now, community garden, mm-hmm. painting a mural, mm-hmm. You know, things like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, they are moving forward because they work together and they're like-minded in a purposeful way.
Are you optimistic about education? I mean, there's so much focus on education right now in this country. Do you think that we will transform our educational system?
Well, I think the billionaires are throwing enough money at it, Gates and Broad and those guys. But until they take the time to ask teachers themselves, instead of trying to be top down about getting their policies pushed through, let's have it be a little more organic. Let's have regular public school teachers who are working in regular homeschool of attendance settings. Let's have them come to the table and say, you know, what they need. And until you get principals who are willing to be supportive collaborators instead of really top-down kind of directors, it's not going to go anywhere.
I think there must be something in the system that makes these principals this way, because I mean, you can go from one school to another and you find the same person sitting in the principal's office.
Mm.
So, And then, you know, I find that I am ways I don't really want to be as a teacher because of the conditions I work in which I work. You know, I never would choose to be.
It's almost as though there is a very silent kind of a renaissance happening. And it's only, I only notice it because it's a transformation, kind of a renaissance that I've undergone myself. I'm 50 years old. And so I grew up in the 60s where your management model was very top down and very directive. And workers were there to be directed. And in order to be a strong leader, you had to be the kind of person who could tell somebody what to do. Mm-hmm. But if you want to educate children, if you want to work with the people who educate children, then it requires a whole different approach. You cannot be telling. You can't tell. I mean, that's part of the problem that we're having, at least, you know, in the schools that I'm aware of and with the people that I'm trying, that I work with, is that nobody likes to be told. Mm-hmm. And we resist scripted curriculum, and we resist all those, you know, other initiatives that are being brought to us and done to us instead of, you know, asking teachers, you know, what is it that you want to do? Mm-hmm. And how can I support that? But education can be transformed. Here's what needs to happen. You need to have those groups of like-minded people, and you need to have open communication and supportive leadership and the money to be able to put all that together to support that. So it's not a matter, you can look at the middle class and you can blame them for living in bigger houses all you want. I mean, Mike Milken did that. He said that Americans spend 17 times more on their house and their car than they do on extra education for their child. Well, if I'm on the bus and I'm already living in a shelter, how am I going to spend, you know, how am I going to spend anything more getting a private tutor for my child? Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, people are living in very dire economic situations, and they, you know, these guys have no clue, no clue. They're talking about the middle class, which is, you know, a completely different story from the reality that we deal with.
So you talk about Mike Milken, and this was at this event you went to. I'm just trying to see if we have any video or anything that we could play the audio from. This is their website. It was Education Nation. Is this it?
If you go to the tour, and then you go to Los Angeles. And then there you have access to the teacher panel and the job one panel.
Okay. And is there going to be audio that we can maybe?
It takes a little while to download, but it will, yeah.
It's not that.
It's there. You can hear it all.
Okay. So, yeah, I'm sure that, you know, they are listening to some teachers. But it's like they, in my view, they tend to say we should treat students in all the ways that we say we should treat students a lot of times. Like, you know, we should find out what they're, you know, where they're coming from culturally, and we should try to integrate that into what they do, and we should have them help to determine what their learning goals are. But then when it comes to teachers, they don't have any of those collaborative ideas. You know, it's and when it comes to bad teachers, they don't have any of those ideas about improving them. You know, they treat teachers the way bad teachers treat students in the district and in our schools. So you're national board certified? And how long did that take?
Oh, that was a year-long process. Yeah.
Not easy.
No, not easy, not easy. But it's a process, I think, that every, that's the teacher town hall. You want the job one.
Oh, okay.
It's a very worthwhile endeavor because it, becoming a National Board Certified Teacher requires you to collect information on your own students, and then it forces you to be reflective about what you're going to do with the information that you found. And there's a whole, you know, big, long set of standards, but the bottom line is that you identify those things that those things that work and don't work, and you identify specific learning needs of specific children. and you design your program, or you reflect about, you, of course, you're teaching the best lesson that you possibly can, but you reflect about what went right and what went wrong in your own lesson.
And
because you usually do it with a cohort of other people, because you make that practice public, that puts a lot of extra pressure on you to be as proactive and as good as you can possibly be.
Mm-hmm. I would like to do that someday.
Oh, you should. Yeah.
It sounds like a better version of what BITSA is supposed to be.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, so if we were to click on this, the Job 1 panel on educationnation.com, the Los Angeles, would we see you?
No, not me. I'm on the teacher panel, but I could... Oh, okay. I did make notes as to, like, specific moments when there were good and then outrageous things happening.
Okay.
Let me get my notebook.
Okay. Good and outrageous.
Thank you, everybody. We're delighted to be here at the beautiful Pacific Design Center here in Los Angeles.
Yeah, it was ironic that they held this thing in Beverly Hills, right? Everybody who works in
it is, but
talking about the achievement gap, which is centered in urban areas where you have a lot of very low-income people, and they all happen to be minorities. And there we were in Beverly Hills. Yeah. So it was, I guess, a comfort zone issue for a lot of the attendees. But Linda Resnick, who is this...
Well, you know how they have conventions. They're always in a place that everybody wants to go to.
Sure.
How is that?
Yeah, Las Vegas. Fun. One of the business people, Linda Resnick, explains 30 minutes in that she has to go offshore to find people who have the math and the technical and the verbal skills to simply work in a call center.
Wow, really?
Yeah.
Offshore.
Now, imagine that you speak with double negatives and you say things like supposedly. That's not... it seems like common language in a lot of places, but, that's not how she wants her company represented when someone calls in to, order flowers or whatever it is.
And you have to go offshore to where... Mm-hmm. Like, what... Where would you go? India?
I suppose, yes.
I mean, where else do they speak really good English that you can't even tell the difference?
Right, yeah. I'm at a loss myself. I don't know, but apparently those places do exist.
We're going to have to wait for this because it's got to catch up to it.
Yeah.
But,
Eli Broad said something really remarkably stunning. He said that... online classes would reduce costs and result in having math and science taught a lot better, he said. Online classes.
I don't know. Well, but we're talking about classroom conditions where 30%, as you said, of students don't do anything.
Right.
I mean, and then they find other things to do.
Yeah.
And maybe, if you have a computer and you're a student...
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have to be next to students who are trying to, pass notes about who they like or, trying to distract you. Maybe you could learn better.
Yeah, that's true. But I don't know if you could make a blanket statement that saying online learning is going to improve the teaching of math and science.
Yeah.
I disagree.
Well, just the confidence with which they make their pronouncements is not... inspiring. So we're still waiting for this thing to load. But so they had a bunch of teachers in the audience.
There were lots of different people in the audience. There were some teachers. I don't know. Politicians and people that sell the educational things. Like programs and. Textbooks, maybe. you know, maybe that's not a fair representation. It was a pretty good cross-section of people that were like leaders in business and education.
But it's just all very capitalistic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the focus was definitely on creating a competent workforce, which is, you know, it's a good thing to be competent. It's a good thing to be marketable. And that's how I secure my future, is by being competent, educated, marketable, having social skills, mm-hmm. being able to, at least in this country, look in your eye and when I shake your hand firmly. It just seems it's a value. Those kinds of things are of value. They have value. The problem that I face every day and that many teachers face every day is that our children don't agree. And there, I don't.
Is there some other principle that they're sort of upholding in not agreeing? Are they rejecting something that's
well, I don't know. And here's another idea that I'm trying to work out, which is something I call reversity. Okay.
Reversity?
Yeah.
I like it.
Already, well,
whatever it is.
It's a term that's been already coined. It's in use. Oh. And I don't mean it as the end of affirmative action or anything like that, but I mean it as a recreation of a new kind of nationalism that does value diversity, but that also places value on the United States of America. I think we've lost sight of that. And Eli Broad likes to quote A Nation at Risk. He likes to say 28 years ago we discovered that we were slipping. But there's no acknowledgement of the fact that we've gone in so many different directions now, you know, with trying to be culturally relevant and speak so many languages and provide so many things to so many different people in so many different languages. Maybe a little nationalism could be a positive thing, you know, but a new kind of, you know, not a brown-shirted kind of fascist nationalism. That's not what I'm talking about. But I'm talking about people turning around and looking back and reaching back with a little bit of appreciation for the wonderful, you know, for infrastructure even of this country. Mm-hmm. Recently I traveled to Costa Rica and where I stayed out in a beach town that was at the end of a very, very, very long and very bad dirt road. And we could not drink the water where we were out of the tap. And so it was expensive to get anywhere and to just simply have water to drink. And as soon as I came home, as soon as we got out of the airport, really, I had a whole new appreciation of infrastructure, mm-hmm. you know, and how well this country actually works. I mean, you can drink the water. I don't care who you are or how much money you have in the bank. You can call 911 and get an ambulance mm-hmm. or a police officer. And there is a court system, regardless of how well or poorly it works. There's a court system. And we have a constitution that guarantees, you know, certain basic rights. And so can we appreciate that by, you know, putting a little bit back into our country instead of telling people that at the same time that we tell people that your country, your language, your culture is beautiful and should be appreciated, so is ours. Mm-hmm. Reversity.
Why is that reversity?
Because it's the opposite of diversity. It looks back at America and says, let's be Americans. This is not a bad thing.
Right.
It's a dirty word. Why is it a dirty word to be an American or to be patriotic?
It's true. I mean, there's a lot of ideology that makes it like shameful to say anything positive about this country.
Right.
I can barely say the word America.
Mm-hmm. And that doesn't appreciate all the young people who are giving their lives.
Right. Well, but I mean, that whole thing about how we should appreciate people giving their lives when it was totally fraudulent.
Yeah,
you know, war is,
but
is
you can
strange.
Support troops without supporting the cause, too. You know,
well, it's just a weird thing to talk about supporting your troops because it implies that you're supporting what they're doing.
Yes.
I mean, I'm sorry that you're doing something that you shouldn't be doing,
mm-hmm.
and that you were wrongheaded to really get involved with it in the first place. Mm-hmm. But since you're doing it, I really feel
mm-hmm.
for you.
Mm-hmm.
What am I talking about? I'm going off. I don't know how this is all going to play out. I mean, there's so many different different directions that people are coming from here.
Yeah. There, I'll give you an example of what I mean, how leadership in schools and teacher collaboration and a little reversity could all work together. And unfortunately, it's an example that illustrates how none of those things are working in classrooms sometimes right now. I know a teacher at a middle school that feeds into mine, and she was so frustrated and angry. She wrote me an email recently describing the students in her classroom, the majority of them, very foul-mouthed, very rude, using the most horrible language in the classroom to each other and to her as a teacher. And she's trying to teach world history in a way that appreciates everybody's point of view and encourages students to think critically, but it's difficult for her to reach even the few students who do want to sit and or participate with her in that learning process, because you've got all these disruptions going on, and she resents the fact that the children will not bring the laptop and they don't want to carry it because it's too heavy. I mean, here's this wonderful learning tool that's been placed into their hands for free, and the kids won't bring them. They're just simply too heavy. And when she tries to call home, the phone numbers are disconnected or they're bad phone numbers. Personally, myself, I've probably made 150 calls home this school year and gotten maybe two back. You know, I've left that many messages and only gotten two phone calls back from parents. And that's very discouraging. But
do the counselors help?
Yeah, they help. They help where they can. Yeah, absolutely. They have enough. They have a lot to do themselves. But what she's worried about is that we're giving away too much and we're making it too easy for the lack of discipline to become pervasive. She's not getting the support that she needs from her school site administration and the staff there to exercise discipline, to have any discipline. And if she's the only teacher with discipline, again, you know, if I'm the only one who communicates that you can transform your life with your education, but that's why it's important, you need to focus on this right now, it becomes impossible for her to do that. She's doing crowd control. And then the dangerous thing becomes that the students are not learning. They're stagnating in their reading levels and their skill levels. And when they come to high school, they won't be prepared. And not only that, now we'll have the discipline issues to deal with, because we're not accustomed to focusing in a classroom. It's just not what we've done, and so that's not what we know how to do. And we spend most of our time, you know, just creating a learning environment, or trying to. She had was one of several teachers who was on a discipline committee and very committed to working together, and the leadership told them, no, you will not have any further meetings. Stunning.
Why did they say that?
I don't know. I don't know why a principal or an administrator would say to a group of teachers who wanted to do something together, you will not do. But the same person told me that. I had an idea for an articulation program between the high school and the middle school where we would trade classrooms for a day. You come and teach mine and I'll go and teach yours, and then we'll get together in the afternoon and find out, okay, are we aligned? Are we doing what we should be doing so that students can be successful in high school? And I was simply going to go and have a conversation with a couple of teachers at that school site, and the principal sent me an email and said, you will not do this at my school. I haven't given the go-ahead for this yet. Uh-huh. Wow. I just want to have a talk.
I started a club for an English teachers club. Mm-hmm. At Santee Education Complex, mm-hmm. and I got a memo from the principal signed by the literacy coach that I would not discuss instruction at the club.
Yeah. See, so any conversation about teacher effectiveness just is, it has no meaning. It's without talking about school effectiveness or an administrator evaluation in a meaningful way.
Well, it would be nice if, you know, we're both in New TLA,
mm-hmm.
if we could turn the union into something
that just occurred to me too.
When yeah. anybody got something like that
from
an administrator,
mm-hmm.
we would show up,
mm-hmm.
you know, mm-hmm. like these good teachers mm-hmm. from schools who have positions and everything, and
mm-hmm.
and we'd show up.
Mm-hmm.
We'd like to talk to you.
Yeah.
What's this note? What's this about?
We're going to put this in your file.
Yeah, well, this goes
your permanent record
in our file for you. So, do you have anything early on in this?
No, it's all
show that I
no, because they spend 20 minutes doing introductions and welcome speeches.
We're as far as 30. Do you have anything at 30?
Eli Broad makes a nice speech at 33 minutes.
If you're going to make billions of dollars in life, where you point out you've been so fortunate on this planet, you've also pledged to die poor or near poor. Well, that's a great thing, because speaking of helping people, in most cases, you will never know and never meet. But as you sit here, you're making lives better. I have a more uber question for you. As a guy who's been around a while, where did it go? Where did we go wrong? What happened to that Alexander Stoddard's charge to build a classroom every 6 days? And he did. What happened to being the beacon of hope, the center of education, the buzz of the planet Earth?
Well, if you go back 28 years to a nation at risk, you say, what's happened those 28 years? Spending in real dollars has gone up 250% while results have been flatlined. You say, why is that? Well, the only thing that changed in the American classroom is instead of a blackboard, you got a whiteboard with marker pens. So we've got two crises, the crisis in our schools, and the second crisis is the American people do not understand how great this crisis is. Now, as a result of what you're doing, Education Nation, our president, Arnie Duncan, Democrats for Education Reform, films like Waiting for Superman, Lottery, and so on, hopefully there's going to be an awareness. Now, what do we have to do to change education? It isn't really rocket science. We know what works. We need a longer school day and a longer school year. Our kids are shortchanged versus the number of academic hours they get versus other countries. Two, we have great teachers, but we need even better teaching, which means we've got to get better math and science teachers, and if that means differential pay, we ought to pay them more. We need better teaching in other ways. We've got to reward excellent teachers in one way or another rather than paying everyone the same. And then when it comes time to laying off teachers, we've got to get rid of the system of what we call LIFO, last in, first out, and keep our best teachers. And there's so many other online learning. We don't have online learning in most of our systems. That's needed. And that'll reduce costs and get math and science taught a lot better than this. And there are a number of other things that we need to do also. For example, collective bargaining agreements, as John will say. They're 200 pages. They should be a thin contract dealing with benefits and compensation and not laying out what happens every 5 minutes in a classroom. So we've got to change the way labor deals with management schools. We need better management. We need better governance. The places we've seen the biggest changes
are where
we have mayoral control. It started in Boston, Chicago, New York, and Washington. And those are places that made the greatest progress in urban areas. Or you have Katrina, which is equivalent to bankruptcy, and you start over. Now, John Dacey is going to make a big difference in this city.
He better. Let me ask you a quick question. If you took all the Broad Foundation money back, if you said, folks, need the checks back, I have another idea, and you were going to write one, for one aspect of education, would it be preschool? What would it be?
It would be better management, starting with the superintendent, starting with all the people that are in administration, and better principals. And if you get that done, they'll provide more money in the classroom. We're spending too much money of each education district's budget outside of the classroom. I think it's all in management and governance.
Jeb Bush was on my wife's show last week. He said the textbook has 5 years to go. Textbooks will be dead in 5 years. Do we all concur?
If we gave every kid an iPad or the equivalent thereof, we wouldn't need textbooks.
And isn't it a little bit odd that students file into class, put away their BlackBerry or device if they are so able to afford one?
Which kids are putting away their BlackBerry?
Take out their earbuds.
I mean, at my school, how much is it?
Close the lid on their laptop if they are so able to afford one.
All right.
Turn off their electronics as if they're taking off from LAX. Sit in linear rows of seats, look up at the front of a classroom at a flat surface with writing on it. The most linear, old-school part of their day is often in school. Anybody? Okay, great. I thought I was really good during that portion, however.
There was one thing that he said that I really did agree
with.
For
the same question that I'm...
Yeah.
And that was, Mr. Broad made the point about better management and better governance. And the whole school district is full of beautiful examples of waste. And Broad says we have to put the money back into the classrooms, and I agree 100% with that.
Mm-hmm. One thing I noticed was when you talked about collective bargaining, like it needs to be, we need to keep the collective out of the bargaining. They shouldn't be, it should be thin, mm-hmm. and it should just have to do with their benefits.
Benefits and compensation.
And nothing to do with what happens every 5 minutes, or in other words, instruction.
Right.
So keep the people out of the instruction. Leave it to the people, to the managers, the administrators.
Yeah, sure. That's one way of looking at it. I think, though, that there might be some value to thinning out the contract a little bit, but I certainly want all my protections. I want to know that... that I can make a mistake, or this whole situation of having classroom evaluation, classroom observation be part of your evaluation. You know, you can make an observation seem one way or another. You know, if a kid is refusing to work because he says he doesn't have a pencil, mm-hmm. which has happened to many of us, I'm sure. But, you know, I'm thinking of one kid yeah. in particular right now who sits in my first period class, won't do any work because he doesn't have a pencil. And I've probably given him, you know, a pencil a day for 6 months. You know, I cannot continue to give this one child a pencil a day for 6 months. And the principal comes in on the one day mm-hmm. when I've just finally had enough.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she writes in my observation that the kid's not doing work because he doesn't have a pencil. It makes me sound ridiculous,
wow.
right?
Yeah.
But who's really ridiculous in this situation? Where's that ridiculousness coming from?
Yeah.
So, in terms of thinning out the contract, maybe a little bit, but, you know, not to the point where I'm going to get written up for not giving a kid a pencil. And yeah.
I've been written up for a lot of things. And so maybe... evaluating administrators is one of the areas that New TLA could get to work on.
I like that one.
Did you want to play another part of this?
I don't know exactly where it is, but Mike Milken says that there's no will in American classrooms anymore.
I don't know if we'll find it.
Yeah, I don't know either. If we go to the next place where he's shown and speaking, yeah, past her. There. That guy.
In our children, to tell them that what they're learning today has a long-term relevance, then I think we'll go a long way in creating
Mike,
jobs.
Mike, how much has your foundation given away over the years?
$1.25 billion.
Same question that I asked of Eli Broad. if you could consolidate it, write one check, one area, one aspect of education, knowing what you know now, what would it be?
Well, first I would tell you it's not money that makes the difference. And I think there's a perception that it's money. It's never money. It's always people. And I think we would continue to invest our money as we have in people. You talked about a hero. Well, 25 years ago, we started this National Educator Award. And we surprised teachers with $25,000 each and $75,000 in professional development overtime. And 2 to 3 million kids have been in that room. And the television cameras and the news cameras have seen the hero was the teacher. They all came for that teacher. And that teacher that day got $25,000, and we always tell them, maybe, when they remember this the rest of their life, that there was 1,000
kids. Yeah, it's not the money. And then I have a problem with the fact that he's focusing on one teacher.
And the governor or the senator was there.
We don't do it in isolation. We don't do our work alone. We shouldn't do our work alone.
Yeah, and that would probably create a lot of tension with the other teachers, knowing how people are.
Yeah, it could. If you forward a little bit here, he says some things that are really out of touch.
Ooh.
So try that.
Country. Yes, we have many of the most talented people in teaching, but you can't feed 3 or 4 million jobs. The second thing that happened in America is that we told the public that the size of your house, the horsepower of your car, was more important than the education of your child or the health of your family. And we're going to loan you money, the government, at a ridiculously low rate. And you have to put nothing down. And where the future of your family is to buy the biggest house possible is far away from where you work, so you spend as much money. And by 2007 in America, middle-class America spent 50% of their income on their house and their car, and 2% of their income on the education of their child, supplemental education of their child. Where does it say that the education of the child is only the state's issue? There is not one country in Asia that has turned over the education, sole education of their children to the government.
Okay, did you want to say something? Because you're
he's comparing this polyglot culture that we have to the homogenous populations of Asia. Mm-hmm. You know, the Koreans and the Chinese and the Indians, and those are pretty homogenous cultures, right?
Right.
I mean, and then he has the audacity to—I don't know how big his house is—to say that we're spending so much more on luxury items than we do on, or you know, even.
Yeah, I wonder what the ratio of how much he spends on his house is to how much he spends on his children's education.
The problem that I really have with this here is that he's so focused on the middle class, and that's not where you have the achievement gap. Okay? That's there were four places where we had achievement gap. We had it US versus other countries, we had it state to state. Maybe that's where your middle class achievement gap is, but you also have it in terms of race and income levels. And if they want to focus their attention and their money where it's going to do the most good, you cannot say to people who teach, you know, seven different languages or seven different cultures in one classroom or more, right? You can't compare them to India or Asia or Korea, whatever. It just doesn't work.
They often compare
Finland. Yeah, that was a biggie.
Yeah, why aren't we like
Finland?
This
whole conversation, right?
But do you not think there's anything to it about how he says, you know, we shouldn't be spending so much money on our, you know, consumption-oriented, a big house, nice car, live far away from work? I mean, isn't it true that that's kind of what we're being sold?
Yeah, yes, it is. And he says that we've left education in the hands of the school, and I would agree with that because that's kind of been my experience. You know, in terms of parental involvement with the students that I see every day.
Okay, so can new TLA save the school system?
New TLA save schools? Can UTLA save schools? I think that if we were purposeful and focused about having supportive and communicative administration, mm-hmm. that we could begin to move in the right direction. Because as I said, you know, teachers are very, very intelligent. And the new TLA group, I'm so impressed with. Every mm-hmm. single time I feel it's such a privilege to go and be in that room with those minds that are all thinking progressively along the same. We should make a school, you know. We should just make our own school.
I think so.
And having supported teacher groups myself as a quasi-administrator, teachers can come up with their own solutions. They know best what needs to happen in that classroom at that moment for those kids, for their children. And, if administration and everybody like these guys would get behind that and support that, it's going to look different everywhere it goes. It's going to look different. There's no cookie-cutter approach. There's no scripted curriculum that's going to solve all the problems, but teacher groups can.
Well, that's why it's so hard to do it from top down. It's because how could you make something different everywhere mm-hmm. unless you give up your authority?
Mm-hmm.
So we're at the end of the allotted time for the show, even though, I mean, it doesn't matter, really, because mm-hmm. we could keep going. But just for consistency, I guess. Is there anything else you want to bring up? I know you just got married and you had a rubric for your husband. I wanted to just touch on that.
Oh, you want to add the husband rubric?
What's your husband? What was your rubric? for finding
a husband? Well, yeah, the rubric covered, I was single for like 16 years.
Wow.
And decided that I didn't want to be single anymore. You know, as I said, I'm 50 and I wanted to be able to make a relationship happen while I was still vital, you know, and could still really get involved in establishing a really good bond with a man. And so I had this rubric written out in terms of how my husband would perceive himself and how he would be perceived by other people, and if he worked out and if he was an outdoor kind of guy, and how I didn't want him to be afraid of wearing Italian shoes and patterned socks and things like that. And he would have to cook, you know, and be in the kitchen with me and all that. So when I met my husband, Troy.
All this?
Yeah. When I met
Troy, of course.
Yeah, Troy. I knew right away. And so when he asked me to marry him after we'd known each other and been dating for about 3 weeks, I knew that it was a safe thing to say yes.
Oh, my God.
And that I wanted to keep him.
But you knew him for a year, though, before you got married.
Before, yeah. Yeah.
Well, congratulations. Wait, did you have it written out with like a four in this area would be, you know, like really...
Actually, no, it didn't have like a scoring, you know,
that's a scoring
system.
Guide.
No, it was just kind of the list, yeah.
Right.
But he's a good one. Hi, Troy.
All right. Well, I hope that you come on more and maybe, you know, help me produce some of these things, because I think, you know.
Yeah, I think we can.
These talks are helpful.
Yes. Lots of good discussion Debbie had.
I'm going to end with a rap song from Mark Hempel, who's with Leonard Eisenberg, does PerDaily.com, a teacher's blog. And this is a couple teachers who made a rap about pink slips. So thanks, Lisa.
Thank you, Nick. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Los Angeles Unified School Board.
This is two teachers and a microphone. We will not stop until all pink slips have been rescinded. No teacher left behind.
You've been served with the pink slip.
Look me in the eye and tell me to my face that I deserve to be replaced. Just cut me out, uproot me from my turf. Who's gonna be the last teacher on earth? Work nothing, get out the class, and don't let the door hit you in the ass. Healthcare, who cares about it anyway? Try teaching with one foot in the grave. Hell no, I ain't going out like that. Stand up, all the people who got my back. Vote out the elected leaders, those who call us worthless bottom feeders. Tax leechers, us teachers, lazy moochers, corrupting the future. Don't tell me to get a grip, cause y'all the next to get served with the pink slip.
Who got the pink slip?
I got the pink slip.
Who got the pink slip?
You got the pink slip.
Don't trip, it's a common disease.
Spread it state to state among public employees.
Every day I'm on the front lines, ripping red tape, juking landmines that were put in place by policymakers. Haven't seen a public school since the Pistons beat the Lakers way back 1989. My teachers went on strike to defend what was mine. Public education, free and for all. So veteran teachers stand proud, stand tall. Some called them greedy, but I knew it wasn't so. Fair wages for workers, it's the only way to go. The battle's for our youth, who do you want to win? Ronald McDonald or Dr. Martin Luther King? Who stands to gain when our public schools fail? Dig deep enough, you're gonna find a money trail. Cause failing schools, the big, big business, and those that profit, let's call them straight bitches. Teach them a lesson and fiscal fitness, cause failing our kids is a social illness. If you're feeling what I'm saying, if you like what you heard, throw those fists in the air and scream out these words. Saying, who got the pink slip?
I got the pink slip.
Who got the pink slip?
You got the pink slip.
Who got the pink slip?
We got the pink slip.
Who got the pink slip?
We all got the pink slip.
Tell me, who got the pink slip?
I got the pink slip.
Who got the pink slip?
You got the pink slip.
Don't trip, it's a common disease.
Bringing labor unions to their knees. Tell me, please, I'm asking you, who's the next to get expelled from school? Struggled in the early years, paid the dues, and you're throwing us out like a pair of shoes. Take a teacher like Aristotle, he'd be on the couch, hitting the bottle. Even Socrates, eating government cheese, begging on the streets with my mind in deeds. Ask Michelle Reed, she's
say it's a good start to fire that old dude, Rene Descartes. But Isaac Newton, yo, his brain was a mess. With a mind like this, he'd be working in defense, building tools that fuel the wars that build the debt. Word to Michael Moore, don't tell me to get a grip. You should have given me an apple, instead I got a pink slip.
Who got the pink slip?
I got the pink slip.
Who got the pink slip?
You got the pink slip.
Who got the pink slip?
We got the pink slip.
Who got the pink slip?
We all got the pink slip.
Throw your fists in the air for our city. Throw your fists in the air for our youth. Throw those fists in the air for our teachers. Throw those fists in the air for our schools. Throw those fists in the air for our city. Throw those fists in the air for our youth. Throw the fists in the air for our teachers. Throw those fists in the air for our schools. Oh yeah, two teachers and a microphone. We got some pink slips of our own to give out. Check it out, here we go. Schwarzenegger, you've been served with a pink slip. Villarigosa, you've been served with a pink slip. John Dean, you've been served with a pink slip. Scott Walker, you've been served with a pink slip. Butch Otter, you've been served with a pink slip. Chris Christie, here's your pink slip. Jason Zahn, you've been served with a pink slip. And Jason Bell, you've been served with a pink slip. The entire LA Times, you get the gas phase. Value added model, you've been served with a pink slip. No child left behind, you've been served with a pink slip. State Assembly, you've been served with a pink slip. State Senate, served with a pink slip.